Hello, I'm Steve Punt.
And I'm Hugh Dennis.
With us are Andy Zaltzman, Mae Martin, Beardy Man and Emma City. And this is...
The Noel Show!
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. And it's that time of year when everything goes egg-shaped. Egg-shaped chocolate.
Easter egg.
Egg-shaped dough.
Easter biscuit.
Egg-shaped cricket ball.
The Australians have been cheating again.
We've made it through the first quarter of 2018 to the Easter bank holiday, traditionally the first potential opportunity of the year to crack out the barbecue and burn some campaign financing documents. It's a big weekend for DIY stores, a time to put up some shelves, mow the lawn, or paint over that anti-Semitic mural you've been meaning to get round to since... since 2012.
Although, to be fair to Jeremy Corbyn, his inability to see a problem in the mural or in his party may mean one of two things. One... he should have gone to Specsavers.
Or two, he's a fan of Magic Eye. Stare at something for long enough.
I have no idea what that is.
Finally, after 6 years...
Oh, I can see it. It's anti-Semitism.
Yes, and on a lighter note, though, spring brings important events in the sporting calendar.
Cambridge won the boat race by accessing all the Oxford team's Facebook data and working out which of them could be persuaded to row slower. And spring bank holiday brings the usual travel chaos, of course. In fact, this year it might be especially bad.
Travel news now, and passengers are advised to leave plenty of time as airports, trains and motorways are struggling to cope as large numbers of Russian diplomats head home for their unexpected holiday. Special security checks are in operation.
So you're flying to Russia? Will that be a return?
I'm afraid not.
Any luggage?
I have 6 suitcases.
I can only see one.
Yes, there are 5 increasingly smaller ones inside it.
Well, it's all been a bit of a diplomatic success for Theresa May, as dozens of countries took action in response to the Salisbury nerve agent attack. What I don't understand about these expulsions is how we knew who to expel. I mean, if we know which diplomats are intelligence agents, why did we let them in the first place? Or have we only just worked it out? And if so, how?
You summoned me, Minister?
Yes. I'm afraid we suspect one or two of you might be spies.
But, Minister, you never said anything before.
Yes, well, times have changed.
Did that romantic dinner that I watched you eat through my binoculars mean nothing?
I'm afraid not. To be honest, we suspect a number of you are not genuine diplomats. Your computer expert, for example, Mr. Turn It On and Off.
What about him?
Well, we suspect him of hacking, along with Mr. I'm Not a Robot Check and Mr. Turn the Firewall Off. And, of course, yourself, Miss...
Data, hand it over.
What a delightful name.
No, your data, hand it over.
The US has sent 60 diplomats home despite Trump failing to enact new sanctions and ignoring advisers by phoning Putin after his election victory. Maybe Trump's a bit distracted because Putin is only one of the topless models that he's having to contend with at the moment. Last weekend, Stormy Daniels, the porn star who claims he's had an affair with her in 2006, went on national television to start giving details.
Yeah, there's more to come, apparently, from Stormy, including how much he liked her name and how it also propositioned Hurricane Higgins and Windy Miller.
Now, Trump, of course, has denied that any affair took place. Stormy, meanwhile, has countered this highly convincing denial by saying that she has evidence, although whatever she comes up with, you suspect that Trump will manage to spin it. She can describe him with no trousers on.
That means nothing.
She spanked him with a magazine.
Didn't happen.
That it was all over too quickly.
I told you. I have no gun control.
Trump, though, will be relieved to have made it to Easter, where he can enjoy his hot cross buns in peace. Hot cross buns being another adult entertainer of his acquaintance.
In Westminster, MPs expressed outrage that Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg wouldn't come and talk to a select committee. To make it worse, he sent them a selection of pictures of more junior staff marked, "People you may know."
But I don't blame him, really, because since becoming televised, select committees have basically just been a chance to book celebrity guests, and naturally the big names would rather do the American version. Zuckerberg has agreed to appear in front of a US congressional committee to answer a series of grueling questions, including...
Mr. Zuckerberg, how much did Facebook know or agree to data mining of their subscribers?
Mr. Zuckerberg, what policies are in place regarding the accessing and or selling of data?
Mr. Zuckerberg, which Muppet do you most resemble? Take this simple test and find out.
A lot of the questions at these sort of hearings seem more designed to impress constituents than to elicit information, but they're not as bad as my least favourite form of questioning, which is the question shouted across the street at someone going into a meeting. Now, this is a form of journalism that completely baffles me. You know, someone gets out of a car and walks towards 10 Downing Street, and someone 10 yards across the road goes...
Are you going to resign, Minister?
It's also completely pointless. They never answer them. They're obviously not going to answer them. What is the point? What do these journalists think is going to happen?
Are you going to resign, Minister?
Oh, hello. Yes, actually, I am.
Great. When are you going to announce it?
Right after this meeting.
Fantastic. I'll shout at you again afterwards.
Right you are. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
It's so annoying. I mean, what is the point of it? It's not a method of eliciting information. It's basically a subtle form of abuse. Shouting...
Are you going to resign, Minister?
...is a journalistically acceptable way of saying...
Minister, is it true that you're shit and you know you are?
Still, happy Easter, eh? And especially to all the Chocolate Factory PR departments coping with people demanding to know why it no longer says Easter on their Easter eggs.
The reason, of course, is that it never did. If you go to Google Images and type in Easter eggs 1980s, you'll see that 30 years ago, the word Easter did not appear on any major brand of egg except Caramac.
The point is, Easter egg is a generic term and has never been widely used on commercial confectionery packaging. It's one of those modern-day myths like Winterval or straight bananas or Donald Trump being a good businessman. Which is not to say there aren't modern innovations to dislike. I don't like this trend this year for repackaging Christmas things for Easter. You know, turkey, stollen, and even carols.
Chocolates, bring on the egg-shaped sweeties. Chocolates, now we've got diabetes.
And now, please welcome to the stage comedian, writer and performer Mae Martin.
A fun fact for you. Did you guys know that 1 in 3 of Europe's drug overdoses occur in the UK? 1 in 3. And I want to do a hilarious comedy set about it. So strap in. You may have heard the phrase opioid crisis in the news this week, which might seem like a relief at first. It's very refreshing to see the word crisis in a headline without the word housing behind it. It is actually bad news. Opioids are a group of drugs that are powerful painkillers, but the fun twist is they're also highly addictive. Right now in the UK, the rate of GPs prescribing opioids is on the rise, and a study in the British Journal of General Practice suggested that many doctors prescribe these pills because they don't want to refuse their patients painkillers when they ask for them. What could be more British than that? Potentially killing people out of like a vague sense of embarrassment? Britain already has Europe's highest proportion of heroin addicts. So seriously, why is that number so high? We have some of the strictest drug laws around, so clearly something's going wrong. Our prisons are full of people who've been harshly penalized in a really draconian way for minor drug offenses, and yet addiction's on the rise. So isn't it time we thought about evolving our drug laws? I'm talking about it, the Green Party's talking about it, Nick Clegg is talking about it even. Which makes sense for Nick Clegg, like a lot of people who lose their jobs and come out of a painful relationship with a controlling partner. He's turned to drugs. I think part of the problem is we don't humanize addiction when we talk about it, so we sort of treat addicts like they're another species. So I want to say this. We all have the potential to be addicted to stuff, right? Whatever it is, sex, gambling, Nando's, online quizzes to find out which character from Friends we are. Like, I'm a Ross with a Monica rising. But this is how I always visualize it. We all have this little, leering, gluttonous, lascivious, dirty old man that lives in the back of our brains, like a tiny, petulant, naked Henry VIII, just living in our brains. Isn't that a nice image? A naked Henry VIII. And anything can wake up your Henry VIII. It could be a relationship. Like, you know, when you get that feeling, like, I know I shouldn't send the 15th text, but I need to tell you my feelings. Obsessive feeling. Or it could be a substance, or it could be an obsession. But when your Henry VIII wakes up, he's like, good afternoon. I've made him French for some reason. But he will eat everything else in your brain. The definition of addiction is when you're doing something compulsively despite knowing it's having negative consequences in your life, right? Give me a cheer if you've ever read an article about how your smartphone might be bad for you. Yeah, we know. We've read the articles. We know there's potentially harmful radiation. Our attention spans are getting shorter. Social media is a parody of human connection. We're all getting lonelier. We know, but we're like, but my friends live in my phone. And the colors are bright and the sounds are nice in my ears. I'm very bad. Like, if I had 8% battery on my phone, you know, when you go into the danger zone, in the red zone, if I needed a charge, I would unplug someone's life support system. I'm not ashamed. And what do all of those things have in common? So food, sex, phones, they all release the pleasure chemical dopamine in the brain. And that's what your Henry VIII wants. That's what he's after, that temporary soothing dopamine high. And drug addiction is just an extreme version of that same impulse that we all have. And I think understanding dopamine and our brains is going to be crucial in how we approach addicts and rehabilitation. So why not promote an understanding of the role dopamine plays in addiction instead of just promoting a staunch anti-drugs rhetoric? Did you know, I think this is so interesting, we can actually affect our own dopamine levels in our brains really easily. We're very malleable. So things like exercise can affect it. And yeah, I know what you're thinking, that crack is a lot easier than exercise. But unlike a gym membership, if you pay for some crack, you're quite likely to use it. But did you guys know that even our social environments can actually affect our brain chemistry? So they did a study on bullied monkeys. Can you think of a sadder phrase than bullied monkeys? They found that monkeys who were being bullied in the wild, their dopamine levels plummet and they start engaging in this very obsessive, addictive behavior. And then when they integrated them with, I guess, kinder monkeys, their dopamine levels shot up and they were much less obsessive and addictive. And I think that's so compelling because when you think about the most severe addicts in society, I think it's fair to say that those people are in a lot of pain and they're suffering and they're self-soothing in extreme ways because they don't have the coping mechanisms or the support networks that they need. And what do we do with them? We throw them in jail in the worst possible environment for their brain chemistry. And it's not working, clearly. So I think we need a new plan. We should let them cuddle the bullied monkeys or something. I don't know. I don't know what the solution is, but I've emailed Teresa. Subject line, I have a naked Henry VIII inside of my brain. Thanks so much, guys.
May Martin! So with the bank holiday upon us, everyone's keeping a keen eye on the weather. We all want to know what's going to be happening over the next few days. So we thought, why not ask someone on the show who is likely to know?
So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the Now Show, Michael Fish.
So, Michael, thank you so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure.
Well, it's a delight to have you here as a national treasure. Can you give us a quick forecast for the bank holiday weekend?
Not that good, I'm afraid.
Not that good a forecast?
Well, close, probably, but...
Oh, OK.
Saturday, sunshine and showers, some of snow over the hills. Sunday, not too bad, frosty start. Monday, yuck.
Do you watch the weather on television? I think it was Ian McCaskill said you were the last of the old-school weathermen. And you could tell the weather just by interpreting the skies.
Yes.
Can you do that? Can you look at the skies and go,
yes,
it's raining, therefore it must be raining?
looking at the sky, it might give you an idea of what's going to happen in 2 or 3 hours, but you certainly can't forecast for days ahead. And the Met Office, with its new computers, can do reasonably accurate forecasts these days to at least 10 days ahead.
Do you like the new style? Bill Giles, for example, complained about the new style of weather maps on the BBC.
Well, that happens every time there's a change, isn't there? I mean, yes, there are certain things I don't like, but there are probably certain things other people don't like.
Do you mind that the word Plymouth is so large that it obscures the Isle of Wight?
they have been moving them recently. Belfast moved, I think, a few weeks
ago.
Did it?
Yeah. I read this today, that in regional forecasts, weathermen are going to be encouraged to use slang terms so that the weather becomes more comprehensible. So for raining, apparently in the Black Country, they say it is bucketing down. in Bristol, they say it's pelting down, and in London, it says it's caning it, apparently, is the term. Do you approve of that?
Well, I suppose one of the innovations that came about when I started was a little bit of sort of freedom of language, because in the old days, everything, as far as a forecast was concerned, had definitions. You couldn't say sunny intervals unless you meant at least 10 minutes sunshine in the hour. You couldn't say heavy rain or light rain. Light rain had to be a certain number of millimetres in a certain number of times. And thankfully, that's all gone now, and you can say...
sunny a bit.
Pissing down or something like that. Yeah.
Say pissing down? Did you really say that? I think he did.
So... obviously, when we knew you were coming in, a lot of people in the production office had questions of things they had always wanted to ask a real weatherman. So we have a few of these.
Yeah, they're fine, yeah. Eh? You'll enjoy them. What is the point of weathermen telling us what the weather was like today?
At least you get it right.
What is your favourite type of weather?
I love snow.
Do you? Why? What do you...
Oh,
do you
it's
snowboard?
So beautiful. You wake up and it's just lovely. You get the urge to go out and throw snowballs.
How difficult were the old magnetic weather symbols?
Well, they were always a problem because they, being magnetic, they had a mind of their own, or sometimes the cameramen might reverse the polarity by turning them round in the hope that they would fall off in the middle of the broadcast. And there was one occasion when a colleague was presenting an autumnal forecast, and it was foggy, and he had the word fog spelt out on the chart behind in three magnetic letters. Halfway through the broadcast, the letter F fell off onto the floor, which wouldn't have mattered, except at the end of the broadcast, he said, "Thank you very much, good night, sorry about the F in fog."
And finally, Michael, if you could describe yourself in terms of the weather, how would you describe yourself?
I would say changeable, but with a few sunny intervals.
Michael Smith, thank you very much.
Now, we managed to catch him just before he flies off to the International Comedy Festival in Melbourne. It's comedian, broadcaster and podcast sensation Andy Zaltzman.
Yes, Steve, I will be going to a country that is currently going through some industrial-level open-cast soul-searching and not entirely liking what it's found. Because over the past week, we have learnt what Australia will do to win a cricket match, and that is absolutely anything. And at the same time, we've also learnt what England will do to win a cricket match, and that is absolutely nothing. Now, it's been a difficult week for me because I love cricket. It's better than life. I love cricket for two main reasons. One, because it is quite obviously the greatest creation in the entire history of humanity. And because, two, I fear reality. Reality is full of news and bastards. It's always disappointing when the soothingly fictitious escapism of sport is tarnished with the kind of bad news and bastardry that is supposed to be restricted to real stuff. Now, this whole sorry porridge began with some low-level cheating, which they might have got away with had they not carried it out with an almost heroic level of stupidity and incompetence. Now, my initial thought on seeing the footage of Cameron Bancroft shoving a small yellow thing down the front of his trousers was, well, what's all the fuss about? Can a cricketer not feed a cornflake to the lucky gerbil in his jockstrap? What is this judgmental universe coming to? Let Muriel eat her breakfast. But it soon became clear that this was underhand as well as underpant. It crossed cricket's wonkily painted line between allowable, basically cheating but not quite actually cheating, and non-allowable, oh no, that is actually just cheating. The upshot, Australia's captain, vice-captain and someone else are, as we speak, being stripped naked and forced to do a walk of shame down Aaronsborough High Street. And I'm also hearing now that the Australian government is currently trying to distract everyone's attention away from their national cricketing embarrassment by launching a full-scale ground invasion of Papua New Guinea. Oh, sorry, is that not public domain yet? Sorry. Sorry, no, there's a press embargo on that until Monday 9 a.m. My mistake, still our little secret. Fundamentally, though, this has been a classic example of asking the right question, how do we turn this test match against a very good South African team, and getting the wrong answer, which was get some sandpaper, try to scuff up the ball, hope to get away with it, despite there being 30-odd cameras because of it being, you know, international sport. And the year 2018. That was the wrong answer. Now, many have felt sorry for Steve Smith. The way I see it, he's brought it on himself. You know, if he wanted to oversee ethical wrongdoing and then attempt to cover it up, he shouldn't have gone into sport. He should have gone into politics and or business, where it's basically fine. And to illustrate this point, this week Smith has given more tearful press conferences than, for example, Mark Zuckerberg, another prominent leader of a franchise caught shoving metaphorical sandpaper into its virtual jockstrap. He has said sorry more often than, for example, the boss of Barclays Bank, who this week agreed to pay $2 billion in America to settle a lawsuit over mis-selling mortgages. That is $2 billion. That's a two, and then a naught, and then three more noughts, and then four noughts, and one more naught. With a dollar sign in front of it. Now, no tearful press conferences from Big Bobby Barclays. He did not sit down in front of the world's media and weepingly say, I just want to apologise for letting down mortgage fans around the world. I'm embarrassed and I'm ashamed. I feel like a boy who's killed his own pet dove. And above all, I want to say sorry to all the kids who have posters of international bankers on their bedroom walls. The sponsors have been pulling out of Australian cricket because they want to cleanse themselves of the ethical staining of these naughty cricketers. Sportswear giant ASICS, for example, terminated its deals with Bancroft and Warner, although they had been content to have their shoes made by women working overlong hours in 37-degree heat in Cambodian factories until they fainted and had to go to hospital, all for less than a living wage. But scuffing a cricket ball, well, somewhere a moral line must be drawn. Albeit a moral line that clearly has dollar signs running through it. It all adds to the pervasive sense in the world at the moment that the greatest challenge facing humanity as a species is how to turn hypocrisy into electricity. If we can nail that, this planet is basically saved. Now, I never thought I'd say this, but I actually feel sorry for Australian cricketers. They cheated, they ballsed up, and in a world of infinite confusion and shifting shades of moral grey, this was a clear bit of black and white. No counter-interpretations, and the world feasted itself on these tasty morsels of judgmental certainty. Thanks very much for listening. Cheers.
Andy Zaltzman. And now would you please welcome to the stage a musician and comedian whose mouth does things us mere mortals can only dream of. It's Beardy Man!
Easter! Yes. I, for one, am reassessing things, you see. Cambridge Analytica, they're wonderful. They're wonderful. You don't agree with me? Let me explain. They have shown us that the societal discord that we had started to accept as the new normal was in fact born not of our mutual animosity towards each other. No! It was born of their selfish, finagling bastardry! Now, if that isn't good news, I don't know what is. To further illuminate this topic, it would be de rigueur to pen a witty little ditty in the style of the whimsical theatre. Gilbert and Sullivan, Rodgers and Hammerstein, that sort of thing. But to my mind, Radio 4 can and should be the home of UK grime. So, dash it all, here we go. They're probably never going to have me on here again anyway, so...
Yeah, Radio 4... Big up Gardener's Question Time. Onside Nicholas Parsons. Shout out shipping forecast. Keyboard warriors to the left and the right. The haters on me, prepare for a fight. The whispers to me when they're typing at night. Why are paying any mind, man? I don't know why. Is it really Russian interference? Makes us want to judge another solely on appearance. I think we all need security clearance to disarm the nukes because they ain't too near us. Cold war steadily warming up again. It's a little bubble that you're living with your friends. Because on Facebook we've come to depend. We depend, we depend. One wrong tweet and the world might end. Just one meme, make you turn on a friend. Would you turn on your friends? Shit. Facebook now won't show you posts from Uncle Steve, cause he posts Jacob Rees-Mogg quotes and he voted leave. Now it only shows you people with whom you agree. Who could blame you if you couldn't see the wood for the trees? But it's alright after all. We'll emerge from out behind our Facebook walls. See, we're not as divided as we once thought. Like- fighter. The soldier's been a coordinated campaign of sowing discord by Cambridge Analytica. Bastards. Too many regimes, better sell that war. Too many displaced, better lock doors. Too many poor, begging for a penny, but there isn't really any money anymore. Poor. Too many people never change their minds. Lefties right now, pick your side. What's your source, man? Pick your side. Pick your side, pick a side. Yeah, you think you can divide us that easy? That we've got nothing left in common now. But we see that you've been harvesting our data at scale. But you'll fail. I'm deleting my account and now I'll be free. You'll algorithmically make me mad, cause I will click if I'm excited or amused or sad. Here's a picture of a cat, see now it's not that bad. I'ma throw my phone in the bin and raise up my hands, cause it's alright after all. Yeah, we've been leaving our whole life behind our Facebook walls. Put your hands up, it's gonna be alright now. Yeah, can you feel that? We're gonna come back down to earth. No more living in the cloud. We'll find places in real life that we can meet. There'll be Corbyn and Theresa dancing naked down Downing Street. It's gonna be all. Oh, look, there's a picture of a cat doing a thing. Oh, it's really funny. I've got to send it to Dave. He loves cats. It's like, what was I doing again? Oh, wait. Oh, I bought my ex that bikini. Oh, there's another picture of a cat. Oh, it's a big
beardy man. Well, Sunday, of course, is April Fool's Day, and the newspapers will inevitably run their April Fool's pretend stories. So we've asked our audience to write some headlines for the Sunday papers.
Corbyn's birth certificate found. Real name, Jeremy Romanoff.
Immigration benefits the economy, says Mail on Sunday.
Stormy Daniels confirms Donald Trump's hands actually above average size.
In the interest of balance, BBC photoshops top hat on top of Jacob Rees-Mogg's top hat. So, thank you very much indeed for those, and thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye!
You've been listening to The Now Show, starring Steve Funk, Hugh Dennis, Mae Martin, Andy Zaltzman, Beardy Man, Emma Siddy and Michael Fish. It was written by the cast with additional material from Gareth Quinn, Jenny LaVille, Laura Major, Mike Shepherd and Heidi Regan. The producer was Matt Strong. It was a BBC Studios production.